Hi everybody and welcome back to NeuroQol and our series of podcasts. So I am Dr. Charlie Whiffin and today we have with me San.
Hi, I'm Dr. Santhini Selvendran.
And Brandon.
Hi, I'm Brandon Smith.
So we're your friendly group of NeuroQol authors and we've been writing the content for you, and today we're going to be talking specifically just a little bit about Unit 5, what's included in Unit 5 and some of our experiences of analysing qualitative data. So you will see that this Unit 5 is called the Principles of Qualitative Analysis. And I think, is it fair to say that probably one of the hardest things, once you've gotten your head around qualitative methodology and maybe some of the kind of philosophical underpinnings of qualitative research, that really this is the next hardest thing to do. And it's really, it always kind of catches me off guard, even now when I come to qualitative data analysis, just how hard it is. San, what's your experience? Do you think this is an easy or hard bit of the qualitative research?
I think it's certainly not easy, and particularly because of the nature of qualitative research. See, if you're talking about, and I'm not saying quantitative research is easy, but there are a bit more rules there. You know, for example, want to compare two variables, then you do a bivariate analysis. So you're like, and all you need to do is just go to the program and click on analyze bivariate analysis.
We're probably really downplaying how hard it is to do statistical analysis, yeah. But there's a principle there.
And I will emphasize that quantitative analysis is not easy, and I have great respect for statisticians and all that sort of thing. But yes, qualitative is a completely different ballgame when it comes to analyzing. And although I think, as we will talk about later, there are certain steps that you will need to follow or certain things that you'll need to do. But it's not as straightforward as saying, if you want to get this, do that test, chi-square, whatever. You know, it's not. It's really not.
I think the key word that you said then was about rules. Like when you do statistical analysis, there are certain rules that everybody lives by. So if you have parametric data, you can do this test, and if it's not parametric, you have to do this sort of test. If you have this sample size, you can do this sort of test. If you're comparing one variable, you do this sort of test. If it's two or three variables, you do these sorts of tests, and everybody agrees to those. So those rules are, you know, really clear. And as long as you understand the principles of those rules, you can kind of check whether you're doing it correctly or not. And a qualitative research, although there are rules, they're not as black and white as that, are they? And I think those rules, when you're in statistical analysis, they give you a certain amount of confidence that you are competently working with your data. And because the clarity of those rules aren't quite the same when you come to qualitative data, you spend a huge amount of time just thinking, am I doing this right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, Brandon, that you recently did the first time you've ever done qualitative, you know, analysis. So I've just said you spend a huge amount of time kind of just thinking, am I doing this right? And you're smiling. For people who are listening, Brandon is smiling and he also has his head in his hands right now. What was it like the first time that you were kind of met with this huge amount of qualitative data?
So I think the analysis part itself, it wasn't necessarily hard, it was just it was long. It was really long. I mean, doing the thematic analysis was the time it took, or how easy I thought it would be start to finish, was what you think it would be, like a straight road, and it really wasn't a straight road. So I mean, I thought it'd be a quick 6 months, understand the background, collect the data, analyze it, then you're done. Paper is 6 months. And it took 2 years. So it's not as straightforward as I think. I think, but having, when you have the qualitative data, when you're familiar with the framework you're going to apply and the thoughts and the process which you're going to try and begin to code it and analyze it, I think because you almost your data doesn't change, but your thoughts on the data and your thoughts on what the data means changed a lot. So there was a lot of back and forwards going through the data and then changing your mind 2 weeks later what you thought initially. And I think it's just a very slow chipping away at the data until you have something that you think represents it in its best light. Because you're collecting, especially when you have an awful lot of data, an awful lot of transcripts, and you're trying to summarize it in a single document. It's very hard to sort of just, you know, to not necessarily to quantify is the wrong word. We don't use numbers, but to describe it, like, especially when you're looking at human experiences, and to think that you can describe it in a single page, I think is quite a naive approach.
I think just wanted to say some, just repeat what you said there. You said, and I thought it was really insightful. You said the data doesn't change, but what you think about the data changes. And that's actually such a key point in qualitative research, that, you know, you, depending on how you look at it, the data, it will depend on what you think is important or not. And, you know, we all, in the same way that, quantitative researchers are trying to take a data set and present it as averages and standard deviations or variance, where they're trying to summarize a huge data set. We're trying to do the same thing with qualitative data. We're still reducing the data set down into something that other people can kind of understand quite quickly, your interpretation or a kind of summary of the data set. So there's a huge amount of data loss. So you're still stripping, you know, paring all of the data down and down until you get to some, distill it down to something which is a kind of like a usable product in your research. And when you look at that data, you have to decide what you think is important enough to label. And what we call that is a code, isn't it? Usually the languages do, you know, different term, there is different terminology, but most people call that a code, or, you know, a label, a meaning unit. So you look at something, you say, right, this is definitely important to my research question or to the participant, so I'm going to draw that out. And not everybody would be drawn to the same things, and that's the challenge. So whereas I might look at a data set and see it through my eyes with my experiences and my background, you know, Sam, you would look at a data set with your experiences and background and maybe come to a slightly different conclusion. And I think that's the challenge, isn't it, in qualitative research. And again, where it differs from quantitative, in that if everybody calculates A plus B equals C, we'll always calculate, should always calculate that in the same, with using the same formula and reach the same answer. And in qualitative research with the same data set, we're often reaching slightly different conclusions depending on who the analyst is. So the position of the researcher is so different to quantitative research. And actually, it's very hard to take yourself completely out of the analytical process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's kind of a good way in this sense, because the interviewer or the analyzer, they do play a role in shaping the data, I think, or shaping the eventual piece that you're gonna send out. I think it's almost like being given a brief. If you think of, like, from an art perspective, it's being like given a brief of paint the picture of a house. Everybody will paint it slightly differently, but you'll everybody having their own interpretation to it, but it will still be a house. It'll still be a picture of a house.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting, the analysis process is an interesting thing, and I'd be interested if either of you took my data set and how you would present that, whether you'd come to the same themes and sub themes and so on. It'd be interesting to see.
I think we would probably come up with slightly different, like, themes and sub themes, but the core message you'd hope would be broadly similar. But I think depending on which, and this is where you start coming into the devil is in the detail in qualitative inquiry, and where I think from an external view, people quite often look at what we do and think, you know, we take a transcript and go, yeah, they're broadly saying they're this, this and the other, that'll do. And that's totally not what we're doing at all. You know, and different analytical strategies will ask us to work with data in slightly different ways. And the unit is giving readers an introduction to a couple of different approaches, namely framework analysis and reflexive thematic analysis, something that we, the three of us, have used. But there are a whole raft of other different analytical frameworks that prioritize certain different aspects of the data. So if you come from something like a content analysis, the emphasis there is far more on coding reliability, i.e. we'd actually all code it exactly the same way, and let's find out how many times people talked about anxiety and how many times people talked about stress, and how much. So there's a much heavier emphasis on a quantification of the qualitative data. And then as you start moving away from kind of that more positivist kind of working qualitative data, it comes into that more interpretive stance, and actually is less about coding reliability and more about actually working with each other as coders and analysts to say, actually, you know, there's something else here. We're missing something here. Oh, you spotted that and I didn't. That's great. But let's see what let's go back and let's relook at the data. Having now made a decision that this thing is important, let's go back and see if we missed it in any of the other data sets. Some analytical strategies are looking at the corpus of materials, so it's more of a collective experience. And I think when you look at things like framework analysis and reflexive thematic analysis, much more on the kind of phenomena of the experience, whereas if you then move to something like interpretive phenomenological analysis, which is something that we have a podcast on, which Harry Mee talks about, that comes much more about understanding the individual lived experience before you understand the kind of higher order experience. It's much more about that individual perspective. So there are subtle differences with each kind of analytical approach, and you have to work out which analytical approach is appropriate for your methodology and which is appropriate to the research question and what you want to find out. So there's a huge amount of, you know, diversity and in the analytical frameworks. And I think the big drive at the moment, certainly that I read about in the literature, is that there's been a tendency within some journals to not present the detail around analysis and the analytical frameworks and the steps that people have been through to actually derive the answers. And I think that is a huge gap. Like if you compare medical writing up in medical journals of qualitative research, and you compare that to a journal which is either a qualitative journal or maybe a sociology journal, or maybe a health going kind of like nursing or that kind of journal, there's a big difference. When you get to analysis, there is a big difference about the amount of detail. Sam, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of times that when you see quality, like I just saw a couple of studies last week or something that I have to prepare for, and they did qualitative study, and when it came to the methods part, they literally just said that, literally they said, we conducted a qualitative analysis and nothing else. And then it was straight to the results with the quotes and everything, which is perfectly fine, but you don't understand, you don't know what kind, and I think this we touched on in one of the earlier podcasts about what kind of study are you doing. Is it like me, I do more descriptive studies, so I need to choose my analytic method or frame based on that, which is why I went with the framework analysis, because it sits very well with what I want to do. And I guess for Brendan it was reflexive thematic analysis. So it's really important that you define these things beforehand, like April, I really need to get to grips with that. And you really, really have to explicitly explain, if you're thinking of writing up your findings or your whole study method, you really have to go through like what you did. And I think we will cover this in the next unit. It also helps with the transparency part of your whole study. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but yeah, it's true. You're absolutely right. You can actually see the stark difference between something written in a nursing journal or a social science journal and those doctors who wanted to work on things. And I don't say this with any bad intent, because I'm a doctor myself, so I'm insulting my own self. So.
but I don't think it's necessarily a problem of the authors.
No, I think
because most of the medical journals come from a positivist science background, the need to articulate like the formulaic requirements of a particular test, you know, there's certain things which are just taken for granted. Like, we don't see all the formulaic working out for a t-test or a chi-squared, do we don't need that, because we just take it on trust that that is the formula that they used. So they apply the same kind of lens, if you like, to qualitative, like kind of shoehorning qualitative into what is really a positivist way of writing up studies, kind of forgetting that actually we don't have formulas, we don't have standard approaches, and if we don't provide that detail and clarity over how the analysis was conducted, how can we be sure or reassured that actually the analysis was conducted in a way that's congruent and commensurate with either the methodology or standard kind of procedures for rigor? And I know you said we'll come on to quality and qualitative research in the next podcast. So there's a huge amount. I think for me, the big thing is about making the invisible visible in a research paper. And it's that idea of moving away from that kind of abracadabra moment of, we did a qualitative study and here's my findings. And you're like, yeah, I know you did more than that. So, you know, I think this was probably this could have been a really technical, really, you know, precision, you know, and that's just lost. That detail is lost.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I think we're in the unit, I'm just trying to think what else we've got in the unit. So there's some basic principles about qualitative data analysis and kind of planning for that. And I think something that I don't see very often in research applications, because I sit on a couple of ethics committees, we always kind of send people off to statisticians to help them work out what to do in their analysis. I've never seen people talk about bringing in an expert in qualitative data analysis to help them sort out their analytical strategy, which I think just in itself is really interesting. So I think I would recommend talking, especially if it's your first qualitative study, or even if it's not your first, you know, talking with other people about how to do analysis. So Sam, we're setting up a new study at the moment, we're working on a new study at the moment, and the analytical element of that, we're kind of co-constructing between you and I and our third author, and trying to work out what it is we're actually interested in, what data is important to us to answer which research question, what's the analytical framework. And actually they're really important discussions that we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves before we really understand the basic principles of what it is that we're interested in. And I think sometimes you can get a bit carried away with QDA, qualitative data analysis, that you want to progress. You know, like Brandon, you were saying, you wanted this kind of 6-month study, it'd be all wrapped up, it would be done. And actually it took you 2 years because there's just so much to try and work through.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I think it's the volume as well. You go in, you say, okay, I'll do a 60-minute interview with somebody, but you don't know how much is going to be said in those 60 minutes. You can get like 30 pages of transcript
in
minutes, or maybe it goes on beyond 60 minutes because the person really has a lot of things to say which are relevant to your research questions or your interview guide. So it's so different. I mean, yes, we have really large data sets in quantitative, but it's so much easier to manage that because all the software that we have. But at the end of the day, in qualitative, your software is not going to help you to really familiarize yourself with the data. You have to still read it. You still have to get yourself immersed in it. The software can't do that for you. Mm. Yeah.
And I think you use the word there, immersion, and that might not be a word that people are familiar with, but it is such an important first step in qualitative analysis, where you just need to kind of be with the data, you know, instead of kind of rushing to code, you know, let's find what's important. It's just about, let's listen to the transcript again. Let's read it again. Let's just make some notes in a, you know, reflexive diary. Let's just think about it. From what might be, what do I think? What am I assuming is going on? And what can I hear is actually going on? Or what is the data telling me? And I think one of those things at the beginning, I talked to a lot of people about, you know, especially when they're really familiar with a subject area. You know, they're trying to understand what they know about this subject area and what their data is telling them about the subject area. And I don't really want to use that word bias, because it's a word of contention in qualitative research. But it's that trying to be, you must be led by your data, and you must also understand what you know about a topic area, for example, because part of that will influence what you are picking out in your data. And I guess the other thing to talk about really is this is an idea of kind of building an audit trail from your data to your findings. And I remember a conversation with you, Brandon, right at the beginning of your journey. It's like, what is this audit trail? What, like, how do I, where is it? Where do I find it? How do I show it? Where is it? And that's also, you know, a really tricky thing that we talk about in qualitative research. But it's that the audit trail is not something that you don't publish it. You don't have a... It's not a file that you have on your, you know, on your computer that says, this is my audit trail. But it is knowing, absolutely knowing where which data have led you to which theme or sub theme, and knowing that you can go from the data to that sub theme or theme, and from that theme back to your data. So you can kind of close, you know where that is. And you can see it either in your primary coding, or you can see it in your reflexive diary. You can see your thinking. You can see it through your what's called memoing, where you think, you know, when you're writing kind of small reflections about data and working with your data. And that is your audit trail, and having that confidence that actually for every theme, you know where it came from, how it was built, what the component parts of it are. And you can see that being built. So like, I know in the paper that we wrote, the one about neurosurgeons' experiences conducting disseminating clinical research, we illustrated that as a synapse. And the audit trail for that synapse illustration, I can see all the way through my reflexive diary, that image building. It wasn't something that I just woke up one day and went, oh, that could be the image. You know, it was... You could see it just all the way through. It's kind of building and building, like little arrows pushing and pulling, or seesaws, or, you know, different hierarchies. And you could see it building. And that's what we mean by an audit trail in qualitative research. What do you guys want to come in on that?
Yeah, I think I like the point you brought up about reflexivity. And I think we did touch on this earlier. I think Brandon mentioned about the, you know, we talked about the data doesn't change, but your thoughts on or interpretation of it might change. So that's your position as a researcher, how you view the data. And that's really feeds into this whole idea of reflexivity. And I also like the point you made, Charlie, that you need to write all these things, have a little diary, or, you know, some people use memos to write their thoughts on the data, or maybe their thoughts on themselves. What did I think? Am I saying the right thing? Is this what this person said? Or is it because I'm a neurosurgeon, so I think this is what it is? So these are really, really important things. And I think a lot of times people don't realize that is quite a key component of analysis. Mm. It's not just, you know, let's just see what the data says and all right, we've got our findings here. No, there's a whole process to it, which, you know, I think as Brendan said, can take years.
It took a long time.
But reflexivity is another one of those kind of subjective, kind of fluffy areas where, you know, especially people who aren't kind of comfortable or familiar with just reflecting before coming into this, actually that reflexive diary is really important, and that audit trail of your ideas, your thoughts, where you're going, you know. And like you say, that, you know, one day you feel one thing about the data and another day you feel something a little bit different. And I think what's always a really important thing to think about is when you maybe over interpreting. So, and again, I know I had several conversations with Brandon about this, where there was data like blocks that, so they were codes that were kind of leading to one thing. And we were wondering whether that thing could, you know, could be interpreted in a particular way. And you have to be really careful with those leaps into interpretation and whether you are over interpreting or interpreting in a way that is more to do with the way that you're thinking rather than the way that the participants may be thinking. So you do have to be really, really careful with, over interpreting certain bits of data. And again, that comes back down again to the type of analysis you want to conduct, because some analyses are more closely descriptive analyses and others demand that more interpretive stance. So you have to know what is kind of allowed within your methodological approach and what it is that you're actually trying to do with your data. And then I guess the last thing just to check in on before we finish this podcast is just touching on analysis software. So there is a small section at the end of the unit talking about analysis software, and San, you said at the beginning that actually that analysis software doesn't do the analysis for the researcher, which I think is a common misunderstanding, that we could put all of our data into this piece of software like Envivo or Atlas, press a button and it would just find our themes for us. Wouldn't that be nice? We'd be done by tea time.
These are themes.
here are your themes. So there are ways QDA can do that for things like discourse analysis. So it can find, I've seen some very pretty diagrams drawn for like the clustering of particular words. So I've seen people do documentary analyses working on they were looking at, I think, some like applications, and they were looking for like buzzwords that people put in applications, and it was looking at successful applications versus unsuccessful applications, and it picked out these string of words that were more heavily associated with successful applications than the words associated with the unsuccessful applications. So I thought that was really interesting, but that's completely descriptive data, like that's not, you know, something that I would normally do. But I think again, it is really interesting. But normally the QDA is simply for kind of data management, data storage. It's really useful for making coding decisions and checking back on your coding decisions. Have either of you done coding by hand versus coding by software? So have you got experience of both?
So I tried it with one transcript and quickly gave up. I tried the post-it note method, but it was a miserable experience. It gets into that audit trail. Come back to the audit trail. In software, it's a little bit more clear cut, and especially if you use the software to such an extent where you can, you know, you look at all of its features and you can see how your codes have changed over time. I mean, you probably could do hand coding, but I think it would take a lot longer. I know a lot of the hardcore qualitative researchers probably live by it, live by it.
Yeah.
But coming in from it, at least for me, coming in from it, it's I think the software just helps, gives you a bit of leverage if you're coming into qualitative analysis for the first time. At least it did for me. Just keep it clearer, especially if you're as pedantic as I am.
What about you, Sam? Which do you prefer?
I think because I was brought up old school, so we were first taught to code by hand. Post-it notes, that sort of thing. So I think the strange thing is that when I had to use the software, I felt that I really wanted to do it by hand, but because the volume was a lot more than the one that I did by hand, I thought, you know what, yeah, I'll just use the software so at least I don't go crazy with too many post-it notes over the tables and the chairs and the floor and the walls.
It's funny, isn't it? Like I when I did my PhD, I used an approach called narrative analysis, and I remember being quite snobby about qualitative software. And I remember talking to somebody at a conference and just be, oh, I would never use software. Oh, no. And now I've used it. Actually, I'm a total convert. Like, I think the audit, I love the audit trail. Like, I'm so confident about where the data have come from. Yeah. And also what I love about it is the manipulation of codes. So, and this wouldn't really, I probably wouldn't suit so much like framework or content, but in the more interpretive analyses that I normally do, I really like the idea of changing. So something that I've originally coded as angry, I can code later as frustration, but I can log that evolution of that code. Mm-hmm. So I can kind of change I was thinking that was angry, but actually if you look at the data around that whole, it's not anger, it doesn't feel like, actually things feels more like frustration, and that's a slight interpretation of what's coming out, and I can log all of those decisions. Whereas by hand, I'm kind of thinking, well, where would I put that notation? How would I make a note of where that, well, I would definitely have it in a reflexive diary, but it wouldn't then be connected to the bit of data that I was changing at the time. So I think there's, but the thing that it does do, and I'm sure of this, and this is the biggest criticism about qualitative data software, is that it does separate you a bit from your data. So it does kind of put up a bit of a wall, and it does, you know, there's something about, you know, if you come back to that immersion thing of when you're kind of, it's a bit like reading a book on a Kindle versus reading a book by page by page and folding the pages and, you know, turning it and putting in a bookmark. There's something about being lost in that data that I think sometimes when you're just reading it on a screen, scrolling through and clicking and, you know, and adding your labels, there's something. Yeah, and I think it does depend on what kind of learner you are and what kind of person you are, as to whether, you know, I'm sure I'm several generations away from, you know, I don't know what they're called, Generation Z or Y. It probably doesn't matter anymore, does it? But certainly, you know, technology is part of our lives now. But there is, I think, whatever you can do to feel immersed and fully connected with your data, you will do a better job, you know. So whether that is printing out your transcripts and reading them, properly reading them rather than scrolling, whether that is, you know, slowing down, playing the audios, it just enhances the richness of your data and your analysis and your interpretation of that. But again, it's the decision that you need to make, you know, either to use it or not use it. And there are pros and cons to both. It's not a case of one is better than the other. So it's a really, it's an in-depth unit. There's lots in there, but there's also lots that isn't in there. So I'd recommend people do some reading. Anyone that's doing qualitative data analysis, they need to do some reading. They've got some, there's some good papers on the reference list at the end of the unit. Enjoy it if you can, once you get over the frightening stages of, oh my God, there's so much to look at. But yes, that's my kind of a final word from me. Stan, any kind of final tip from you?
I would just say, don't be afraid to do qualitative data analysis. I mean, if you're new, I think it's it's always the experience that's important, and the person, I mean, you can always get help from experts and people who are very familiar with qualitative. So the important thing is just to get started and don't feel that I don't know what's a code, you know, I don't know what's that, you know, just just read the unit, have an idea, and then just get started.
And just following up from that, you just said about it, but I think analysing in a team is really nice. You know, the opportunity to, whether it's you and a supervisor, or it's you and a critical friend, or it's, you know, but having that opportunity to actually verbalise your understanding of the data with somebody else, I think it's always, will always advance your analysis. Brandon, any kind of tips from you, final thoughts?
I'd say keep an open mind with things as well. So especially when it comes to things like software or methods that, you know, ways in which you can analyse your data, I think keep an open mind and sort of leave everything that you thought you knew at the door. Because it really is different. And even between projects, I think even if I went back to it now, I'd probably do it slightly differently just to give it a go and see what works best. But yeah, keeping an open mind is really important with this.
Yeah. Yeah, well, wise words from both of you. So so thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in. Enjoy Unit 5, and we will meet you again, hopefully, when we talk about Unit 6.